Hi, this is Barbara DeAngelis, and I wanted to share my love and my respect for my wonderful friend Wayne Dyer. Whenever I'm asked by audiences, who do you admire in the personal growth field? Who is one of your inspirations? There's very few people on that list, but one of them is definitely Wayne. And there's a very simple reason. Wayne is one of the only teachers in the field of personal growth and spiritual development that I believe is really practicing what he preaches, is really walking his talk. Wayne is what you see is what you get. He's not somebody who records great tapes and inspirational speeches and then is a jerk in his life, or is not loving to people or to himself, or isn't growing or is kind of riding on his past success. He's a real spiritual pioneer and explorer. And whenever Wayne and I have the fortune to get together, usually when we're speaking on the same bill somewhere, we stay up late and just sit and talk about not what shows we were on or how much we were paid for something. We talk about God. We talk about our spiritual experiences. We talk about the great inner challenges that we're facing, our passion for the process of self-discovery, and we just get high on being fellow travelers. That's why I love Wayne, because he's keeping me company on the path and doing it with such love, such compassion, and such grace. And I'm so happy that he's keeping you company too.
Volume 5, Being in the Moment.
In The Death of Ivan Illich, Tolstoy's wonderful short story, Ivan Illich was an accountant in Moscow who was on his deathbed knowing that he was going to die. And the story is the story of what is going on inside of him as he passes his life in review. And the sentence that hit me like a thunderbolt as I read that was, what if my whole life has been wrong? What if I did it all wrong? I mean, what if all of the order and all of the things and all of the rules and all of the right things that Ivan did, because he was very organized and thorough about his life, what if all of those things turn out not to be the right thing? And Tolstoy is saying, even when you've only got a few hours left, you can still change that and appreciate what you have right here and right now. And that's the whole message of that. It does seem a bit late to me, and not something you have to work on, but I wonder how many people in this audience tonight have had a close brush with death, or have had somebody close to them have that, or maybe been in an accident where you have been there on that bed wondering whether you're going to survive. And most people who have that kind of an experience in their lives at one time or another almost always say, it taught me the most valuable lesson of my life. That is, that I've got to take each day that I live and make it complete, whole, filling, creative, exciting for me. The problem is that it shouldn't have to take a brush with death to do something so natural, so simple, so basic, and that is to live your life the way you want to, on your terms, without having to answer to anyone else. Well, the whole idea of that circle and trying to get out of that circle and get between point B and C means taking each day of your life as if it were the last, not as if it were the first. See, a lot of people say, you know, you hear the slogan on the bumper stickers, this is the first day of the rest of your life. I like the idea of thinking, this is the last day of my life, and I am going to live it as if I didn't have any more. Because the truth is, that you don't. You do know. The past is over for all of us. The future is promised to none of us. All we get is this one. It's all we get. And each one of us knows someone close to us, our own age, who was wiped out in a silly accident, who was dropped dead of a heart attack, who, whatever it may be. And everyone here, if you don't know this, you haven't really been alive, that you're going to have to face a last day. We all do. Death is as important a part of life as living it. And understanding that and leading your life on those terms can be the most freeing, exhilarating, exciting thing that you can have. And what I would like to see my profession do more of, and that is help people to go between being normal and looking at your potential for happiness, fulfillment in yourself.
If you're the kind of person who has your mind filled with 10 different things that you have to do, and that is producing anxiety, stress, ulcers, colds, backaches, headaches, cramps, runny noses, you know, all of the kinds of physical reactions and manifestations of that kind of thinking, then you have to look at how can you just get a blank mind, or how can you get a quiet mind? How can you just understand that, supposing you're thinking about, you got to get to work, you've got this report you got to get out, you got to get your taxes done, you got to stop and get some diapers on the way home, the kids need to have bananas, and they've got dance lessons I've got to get them to, and you know, an endless catalog of activities. By using your mind to do that and to occupy it all the time, none of that is going to get done. See, all of that is going to get done. Regardless, if you're the kind of person who does those things, it's going to get done. The question is, how do you use your present moments? See, any time you use up your present moment, or any time that you are thinking anxious thoughts, you're denying the present. You're using up the present moment. Instead of using it up in a productive, peaceful, serene, calm way, you are somehow believing that you can't get through this day or this moment any other way, that if I don't think about it and worry about it and be anxious about it. But the fact is, it's going to get done. Your taxes are going to get done. You're not going to jail. You're not the kind of person who's going to opt to just simply not do your taxes. You're going to get the diapers. You're going to get the report done. All of that you're going to get done. Otherwise, you wouldn't be in the position that you're in. You would be doing something else, all right? So if you know that it's going to get done, the question is, what's the most efficient and effective and peaceful way to get things done? I use the analogy often of when you're in a hurry, like when your body is in a hurry. That's when you're least effective at things. That's when you always drop something. You'll drop the keys, and then you'll fall, and then you'll start sweating. And then when you start sweating, you find yourself getting more upset, and you'll forget something. And you walk out the door and you slam the door and you left the key on the inside. Now you don't have a key. I've talked about when you take a shower. If you rush through a shower because you only have 5 minutes to take a shower and you finish and you take your shower and then you dry yourself off, you didn't need to take a shower because you're already dirty again. I mean, you're already sweating and all. You can take the same 5 minutes and take a shower if that's all you have. And you can do it peacefully. The same 5 minutes. You can push all of the other stuff out, and you can just relax. And if you've got 3 minutes, instead of rushing through it, you can just let the water pour. You can experience the water. You can wash your body. You can do whatever. You can dry it all off. And when you finish, you're not sweating. And you had the same amount of time. The nervousness and all of that comes from the way that you decide to process. Now, in the physical world, you understand that if you hurry and rush and are filled with 1,000 different activities, that you have decreased your efficiency. Why isn't the same thing true in the mental world? In your mind. If you are filling your mind with all of the things that you have to do and you're worried about all of those things and get yourself all consumed with them, then you're still going to be less efficient, less effective, and you're still going to be cluttered. At a moment like that, you put on a tape. If you're going to drive, you got to drive. You can't get the bananas and the diapers and the report done and the IRS taken care of in the car on the freeway. You can't do that then. You're driving. So why not be here now, as Ram Dass says. Be here now. Here's some music. Put on a tape. Meditate right there. Don't close your eyes. But just, like, push it all out. Okay, it's all going to get, all of that's going to get out. But meantime, I'm going to enjoy this.
Do you remember when you were in grade school? Remember before you went to school? All you could think about was getting to school. Just like, that's it. Or even when you're in your playpen, you're almost trained to think, well, when I get out of the playpen, I get the whole room. Boy, just get me out of this playpen. Then you get out of the playpen, you get the room, and you think, Jesus, I'd like to go into the next room. But they got one of those things across the hall there, so I got to get past that gate that they put there. But boy, when I can get into both rooms, and then maybe I can get into the cupboards and get the pans out, that'll be when I arrive. And then it's like, maybe I can go down into the yard. So the yard becomes the goal. And you get out of the yard, and it's the block. And then you get out of the block, and it's like going around the block. Woo, first time around the block. But, you know, there's a street to cross. It's like, it's always next. You finally get into school. You're in elementary school. Elementary school. And all you can think about is getting out. So because elementary school, what I remember about elementary school is lines. I hated lines and permission. 5 years, you pee whenever you feel like it. All of a sudden, now you gotta ask permission. I don't wanna ask permission to pee anymore. So it's like, let me out of here. And in lines, you're going to geography now and you stand in line. I mean, who the hell in the world goes to anything like this? And the lines don't move. You know, you just stand there waiting. I guess if it moved, it would be a parade, wouldn't it? It wouldn't be a line. Anyway, all you can think about is junior high. So you can get to junior high and you get out of line. So you get to junior high and you find out that this ain't nothing. This is not the place to be, junior high, because they don't treat us like adults at all. We have to take whatever courses they give us, and we have always being told to stop touching each other. Well, we like to touch each other in junior high. And sit up. Quiet. No talking. Boy, my teacher knew that word real well. No talking. I said, no talking. No talking. Everybody talked whenever she said that. But anyway, it was like, so I get out of junior high. That'll be it. When I get to high school, oh, high school is going to be, that's it. Your life is now complete. You get to go to high school. Whew, finally. You get into high school and you realize you're just a little freshman. Nothing. Freshman. Even the word sounds yucky. Freshman? So you just bypass that. You say, well, all right, I'll put up with this because next year I'll be a senior underclassman. Euphemism for a sophomore. So you get, when I get in the 10th grade, then I can, and then it's like nothing in the world counts except being an upperclassman, except getting a driver's license, because that's what life is all about when you're 14 and 15, is getting a driver's license. I mean, that's all there is. I told my daughter, I said, hey, maybe next summer we'll go to Finland, then we'll go from there, we'll go to Greece and go on the Greek islands, and then spend a nice time there, we'll learn all about those other coasts. She said, that'd be great, Dad, but my birthday's August 1st, and I get my driver's license, and I know that roads means a lot to you, but, you know, I want to drive. I want to be home. She wants to leave Greece to come home and get her driver's license, because that's all there is, so she can drive around and go nowhere. But it gives you the freedom, you see, so she's thinking about that until you start thinking about dating. Wow, when I can date, boy, that's when my life will get complete. Or finally, it's like when I get out of this high school, Jesus, it'll be so great that I won't have to be told what to do. And I mean, finally, you work for that, and you work for it, and you get out of high school, and there's no bands. You know, there's a little ceremony, and all of a sudden, there's no scholarship to life out there at all. You got to face it. And you get out there, and you say, well, maybe my life will start when I go to college. That'll be it. And you go through college, and you think, nah, this is not it at all. It's just more of the same, just studying. You know, I just get to pick what classes I want, but it's the same old stuff. I get out of college. They tell me when you get married, that's when your life really begins. That's when it's great. So I'll get married. That's great. And then you find out that he makes funny noises that he never made before. Got pimples on his back. Can you imagine? It's just too much. So it's like, all right, marriage may not be it, but they tell me when you have your first kid, boy, when you have a child, you know, that makes you kind of complete with the universe. So, all right, I'm not much now, all right? I'm not really a person yet. I'm sort of an apprentice person, okay? But when I have that child, then I'll be complete. And then you have a girl. Well, maybe I'll have a real child the next time. Only kidding, only kidding. They say that the divorce is the thing that really makes your life go. So as soon as I get this out of my life over here, and this person who's dragged me down all the time, that'll do it. Or maybe the real problem is, how did I get here anyway? My great-great-grandparents landed here, and I'm still here. What the hell am I doing here? Ah, that's it. I'll go to Houston. By the time I get to Houston, then I'll be. And it's this endless kind of thing, and maybe when I get a new job, that'll be it. Nah, they tell me when you get the promotion, boy, that's the thing that really makes your life start. What I've heard really is that when you retire, as soon as you retire, that's when life really gets going. And then you retire, and you hear people retire talking about the good old days. They never had one in their whole life. Because they're always postponing it. There's always this aversion to now. And now, it's like everything you do in your life, you do in this moment. Jackson Browne has a song, and in one of the lines of his songs, he said, "No matter where I go, I can't help thinking I'm just a day away from where I want to be. Just a day away from where I want to be." There aren't many people who understand that this is, that Carly Simon said, these are the good old days. These are the good old days. And getting into them and enjoying them and being able to be there. A person who's always goal setting, always thinking about the future, always consumed with what it's going to be like then, when they get to this point, they just simply set another one. And they're always a world of strivers, never arriving. They're doomed to eternal frustration rather than an appreciation of anything. You see, everything you do in this moment, everything you do in this moment, you feel guilty. Why would you feel guilty in a moment? Because you can use up this moment. The guilt can only take place now, like everything. So you use up this moment thinking about things that have already happened in the past, over which you have absolutely no control, and that's how you use up this moment. Guilt doesn't. You'll hear psychiatrists talking about it's living in the past. It's not living in the past. No one can live in the past. You can only live now, think using up now by reminiscing about the past or feeling bad about the past or worry. People say, I worry because I live in the future. You're not living in the future. You're just taking up this moment, being consumed with something that's going to happen in the future over which you have no control. And it's such a sensible thing to do is to get rid of that.
Have you been looking at crazy things in the news lately? Suicide packs? The suicide rate among children ages 8 to 12 has gone up 400% in one decade. 400%. What's going on? Children in therapy has gone up 700%. How come? Children having, quote, nervous breakdowns. Children with depression. Kids on tranquilizers. Type A toddlers. Type A toddlers. You know what type A is? Type A behavior. It's like you have to always get ahead. You have to do things fast. My daughter came home from school in the second grade and said to me, I've got to get all A's. I said, why? For what? She said, well, the teacher told us if we didn't get all A's, we wouldn't get into college. I said, you're 7 years old. College is a little ways away yet. I mean, what is that for? Do you have to teach your children to read at one or in the womb? You know, holding up cue cards to them in the womb with like a sonogram, you know? Can you read this one yet? In the New York Times, they had a story about children 18 months old. Now, I got a daughter that age. I got a daughter every age, all right? She's in diapers. They're giving them entrance exams to get into nursery school so they can get into the right preschool, so they can get into the right grade school, and so they can get into the right college. 18 months old, still saying wee-wee, caca, poo-poo, and doing that in their diapers. And they're going off to take tests. I mean, what kind of a test do you give an 18-month-old? The stress. I mean, who wants children filled with stress? What's wrong with just going out into the world and being two and three and enjoying it? Celebrate the present moments of your children's lives. Get rid of this notion that they're apprentice people, that they're on their way to becoming a person. A woman called me in Boston on a talk show, and she said, if there's one thing, and you ever talk to parents or write about parenting, if there's one thing, she had lost her daughter to leukemia at 4.
She said, teach them to value every moment they have. See them as whole. See them as complete now. Celebrate their three-year-oldness. Love that. Play in that. Enjoy that. Let the rest of that work itself out. It will. It will. They're all on the path. We're all on this path together. They don't have to get ahead of the other guy in order to be happy. And all they'll get, even if they do get ahead of the other guy, is an ulcer as a reward. If they spend their whole life in this race, this rat race, trying to beat everybody else down. I mean, the purpose of life is to enjoy it and to help other people to do the same. And if you learn how to do that, you're not going to be selfish. You're going to never be a burden to anybody else in your life. Imagine being a person who always knows how to enjoy life, no matter what comes down the pike. Imagine that. What a great notion, isn't it? You can never be a burden to anybody else. That's the least selfish thing you can do in life. The most selfish thing you can do is constantly be somebody else's burden. I did this for you. You have to do this for me. I invited you to my house. You haven't invited back. I sent out 343 Christmas cards last year. I only got 341 back. I'm going to find out who these people are that don't send me things back. And you go through like counting. Remember The Little Prince? Remember The Little Prince? If you haven't read it, read it to your children. Read it out loud to them, even if they're 37. Read it out loud to them, all right? They need to hear that message, that parable, that wonderful parable of the prince who would meet people who were counting stars instead of enjoying them. His whole life was, I gotta find out how many there are. 3,468, 3,469. They spend their whole life just counting. They say in the East, there's quite a difference. In the East, they contemplate the forest. And in the West, we count the trees. And there's a different philosophical approach to it. Melting that, merging that, bringing those notions together to raise children who are free from stress, who are free from anxiety, who understand the beauty of every moment rather than counting it and categorizing it and getting a label put on it.
On the whole quality of complaining and whining, neurotics complain, neurotics whine, neurotics find fault. They don't like the way things are going. Things are always so bad. Things are never going to get any better. I just know that. They find fault almost everywhere you go. You ever get around people like that who are always finding fault with everything? And then there are people over here who kind of accept the world the way it is, but they really don't feel like they're active doers about it. And over here, you see, I think there are critics and complainers, and there are people who accept things, and then there are no limit people. These are doers. Doers at the highest level. They know that if anything is going to get changed in life, including themselves, that they can't sit around and complain about it to make it happen. And so they practice. And so you can practice. The things you don't like, complaining, fault-finding, blaming, wishing, hoping, they're all the tools that neurotics use. Whereas highly functioning, no-limit people are those who don't have time for the complaints. They somehow, they have almost like an inner sense of their own destiny, an inner sense of their own mission, and they know they've only got so much time, we have a limited amount of time here, and the amount of time that I'm given is a blessing. It's a miracle. It's a miracle. To me, as Whitman said, every cubic inch of space is a miracle.
One of my favorite poets is Rumi, a Sufi poet who lived about 1,000 years ago. And he said, do you think I know what I am doing? That for one breath or half breath I belong to myself? As much as a pen knows what it's writing, or the ball can guess where it's going next. And he equated himself to this sort of being that was being propelled through life, and that he just sort of let go and let God let go and allowed this surrendering process to be the thing that just guided your life. And I must say that in most of my life, and this is over 50 years now, I've had very few goals. Very few goals. Now, I can hear arguments and I can hear the doubts, and because you've been exposed to this for your whole lifetime. And then you say things like, well, if I want to go to the bathroom, I have to have a goal to get there. And I'm not here to dispute any of that, nor to make anybody wrong who believes in these things strongly. All I'm suggesting is that you can have satori, an instant moment of shifting around when you are ready and willing, and God works in very mysterious ways. If you have this readiness and you say, I'm just turning this whole problem, this whole struggle over, and I know that the universe, that this organizing divinity that is a part of everything, that is invisible, knows what it's doing, and I'm going to allow it to work through me, and I know that I'll be guided, and I'm not alone. And the moment that you have that awareness that you're not alone and that you're going to be guided, then goals don't seem to be nearly as significant or as important. Life is really what happens to you while you're making other plans. And there's an old story about if you really want to make God laugh, if you really want to make God laugh, tell her your plans. When you let go and let God and stop this insistence that you have to have everything planned out and become free, then you begin to experience this heightened awareness. One of the suggestions I'd like to give for getting rid of this whole insistence that you have goals is just to be willing. Willingness is the key word here. If you are willing to do what it takes to turn whatever vision you might have into reality, then you'll begin to see the opportunity showing up. If you have to have it all planned up in a goal and set out while you're making your plan, you'll miss 200 opportunities. Another belief that most of us have hung on to for most of our lives because we've had it handed to us is that we believe that we always have to do our best. I hear this almost every single day from motivational speakers, from athletes. I have to do my best. I'd like to really challenge that. You don't have to be always performing and always doing things exactly at top level. As a matter of fact, that perfectionistic idea that things always have to be done perfectly is very often the thing that will keep you from achieving anything. As a doctoral student, I can remember, and as a doctoral advisor, after I received my own doctorate, I can remember having many students who would go through all of the coursework, and then they couldn't write their dissertation because they just couldn't get it right. And I'd say, look, you don't have to do your best at this thing. Just get it done if you ever want to be able to have your doctorate. Well, this isn't right, and this word isn't there. And if you're constantly preoccupied with perfectionism, it will be spelled paralysis in the end because you will be paralyzed and not be able to accomplish things. Get rid of that whole idea of best and just do. Just substitute doing for best. There's an ancient book of wisdom called the Tao Te Ching, and they comment in there on what it is that constitutes a sensible person. It says, the five colors can blind, the five tones deafen, the five tastes cloy. The race, the hunt can drive men mad, and their booty leaves them no peace. Therefore, the sensible man prefers the inner to the outer eye. And letting go of all of this perfectionistic idea that you have to do things a certain way is really moving to the inner rather than the outer eye and not allowing yourself to be blinded and deafened and cloyed and saddened by the idea that you always have to do things in a certain way. One of the suggestions I would make for getting rid of this idea that you always have to do your best at everything that you do is stop imposing this on yourself and on your children, to get rid of that idea and instead replace that with, there's going to be a few things that I'm going to do very well and maybe even my very best, maybe a few, maybe one or two, but all the rest of the things that I do in my life, I'm just going to do and I'm going to enjoy them. And I'm going to take that pressure off of my children as well. Because it's far more important for them to do and enjoy and be at peace and be blissful than it is to live with all of the ulcer-producing neurosis that comes from constantly being told that you could do a little bit better. You always have to do your best. Your best is really just an idea that the ego keeps promoting in you in order to keep you away from the higher part of yourself, which says, you don't have to perform at all. You don't have to beat anybody. You don't have to do anything. You just have to be. Be at peace. Be at joy. Be at bliss. And then whatever it is that you do, you will be unattached to the outcome anyway. You'll be in process. You'll just be enjoying the whole journey rather than seeking out all of these destinations that other people have imposed on you.
I think goals are very important for all of us to have. I think having a plan is really important and significant. I don't think it's healthy to fall in love with your plan. If you can't shift gears, if you can't, let's say you're on a trip, you're going out west, and you've made reservations all along the way, you know, to stop at a Holiday Inn or whatever, wherever you're stopping as you go along. And you get to a place that is really interesting and intriguing, where you've never been before. Maybe they're having a rodeo the next day in Amarillo or something, and you'd really like to stop and stay and see that, but you can't because your plan, your goals, your objectives are ruling you rather than you ruling your life. If you can't adjust and be flexible with the things you want for yourself, then I think that's unhealthy. Also, I think goal setting itself is healthy in the sense that you do it in the present moment. I'll give you an example in my own life. On October 21st of last year, I ran my very first marathon, 26.2 miles, all right? When I started running a year or so before that, I didn't have any idea about running a marathon. What I had an idea was that I wanted to be more physically fit in my own life, and I wanted to see if I could run each day, one day at a time, whatever my body said I could do, and at whatever pace I wanted to. And I started out doing that, and that was a goal for me. Did it one day, and the next day I said, would I like to try that again? Even though my shins were hurting and I was out of breath and so on, I said, yes, I'll do it one more day, all right? After 3 or 4 weeks, instead of running 1.2 or 1.5 miles, I was running 2 miles. Not because I had upgraded my goal, my body allowed itself to go faster and to go a little bit further. It was just only natural. After continuing in that process of individual daily goals for myself, which is living in the present and enjoying yourself, you have an automatic kind of upgrading of those goals for yourself. Within a year, there I was at the starting line of a race to run 26 miles, which if you'd have said a year before I could do that, I would have thought, you must be crazy to think anybody would even want to run 26 miles. And it's an attitude. But like each goal that you have for yourself, let's say you want to lose weight. You want to quit smoking. You want to eliminate addictive behavior in your life, whatever it may be. The only way, it seems to me, that it's sensible to attack a problem like losing weight is to say to yourself, today, just today, or quitting smoking, just today can I go 24 hours, one day, or even a half a day, or even a few hours, without a cigarette, without eating sugar, or whatever it may be. Can I do that? Well, the answer, of course, anybody can go a day. That's no big deal. Well, the only way you get to live your life is in a day segment, even less than that. So you do that. Then what you are at the end of that 24-hour period, you're a new person. Now, if today you say to yourself, I'm only going to want a cigarette tomorrow anyway, who am I kidding? So I might as well have one now. Or I'm only going to want to have a hot fudge sundae tomorrow night, so why not have one tonight too? You mean I can never have another sundae the rest of my life? That'll drive you right to the refrigerator faster than anything, you see? You don't do that because someday you may eat hot fudge sundaes every night. I have one, you know, very often, whenever I feel like having one. But I add a whole lot of other dimensions to my life which permit that. So it's like you take that day and you say to yourself, at the end of this day, I now have 24-hour history of no nicotine in my body. So you take that one day. Now you're a different person. Let that person decide whether they want to go another day. Don't let the person who wants one right now, let the person who's got 24 hours of success behind them decide. And then let the next person, the next day, now you've got 48 hours behind you. Let that new person, because you're a new person every day. Anybody who's ever been in alcoholic treatment, Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's the only program that's had even a tiny bit of success, knows that their slogan, one day at a time, is the way that you handle that. You just deal with your life one day at a time. And you can have a lot of goals in this day and not be living in the future at all. But I'd be absurd to get up here and say, you should never have goals for yourself. So everybody has a goal. It's how much you can do it in the present moment, I think, that counts.
Since I've given up some of my attachment to having to be right, and since I've really embarked more on a path, and I don't even know how I got on this path, but it's just where I am, of sending out love and peace and harmony and contentment and so on, I've never had more, quote, success come into my life. The things that I write get read, and the tapes that I make get circulated. My demand for being a speaker and those kinds of things has increased, and people want me to do television shows and even to do my own and to write plays. People want me to do things and are inviting me to do things that never even came to me before. So success, quote, in all of those external fashions, achievement has gone up. I mean, I have achieved at a higher level. My writing is better than it's ever been. I feel better about myself. I seem to be performing on stage and in my writing at a higher level. And yet I'm talking about going beyond all of those things. It's like that great irony, that great paradox that is always with us, is that when you get focused on what you want to do and not attached to the results, but just following your bliss, just keeping your bliss and your bliss always being in the service of others, that all of those things that we seek so desperately, the success, the achievement, the performance, seem to follow after us and arrive in our life in the amounts that are absolutely necessary for taking care of us. But as long as we find ourselves pushing for them and demanding them and chasing after them and striving for them, then we never get to arriving. The only vehicle that's available to take us from striving to arriving is detachment from the fruits of our labors.
One of my close friends whom I quote frequently, his name is Edgar Mitchell. You may not recognize the name, but you'll remember the photos. Back in 1971, Ed Mitchell was the sixth man to walk on the moon. He was the Apollo 14 commander. And Edgar is a PhD from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology in nuclear physics. That's as left-brained as it gets, folks. That's as scientific and left-brained as you can be, and was trained as a scientist. And he had what I talk about in Real Magic, what I call a Satori experience while he was on the moon. And I've shared many evenings with him talking about his walking on the moon, what that was like. We have in our living room a large photograph of the Earth taken from the surface of the moon, signed by Dr. Mitchell, a very beautiful memento indeed. And this word Satori is something that came across in reading on some books on Eastern philosophy for Real Magic. And it translates roughly in English to instant awakening, an instant awakening. See, most of us in the West have come to believe that in order to awaken or to be enlightened or to reach certain levels of achievement or to be successful and so on, we have to follow a prescribed set of rules and dogma. And those rules are handed to us by other people as we go through our developmental processes. And we believe that you have to set goals, and you have to struggle, and you have to sacrifice, and you have to work hard, and you have to go to school, and you have to get the proper training, and you have to find somebody who knows more than you do, and you have to be an apprentice, and then eventually you work your way up the ladder, and ultimately we reach this place called enlightenment or success or whatever you want to call it. And that is a possibility for all of us. Certainly it's one way to get there. It takes a long time. Sometimes we get there and then it's over. But it's still a way. All right? And then when you read Eastern philosophy and you become engrossed in the power of the mind and the power of the divine intelligence that flows through all of us, and you look at spiritual masters who've walked among us over the centuries, you discover that there's another way. And that other way is like in an instant, in a moment. It's like, and most of us can trace back to the very significant and dramatic changes that we have had take place in our own lives to an instant, to a moment. And then we walk away and leave it behind. So here's Ed Mitchell walking on the moon, 1971, and he looks to his left, and he can see an infinity of heavenly bodies hurling through space at thousands of miles per hour, all synchronized in a collaboration with eternity. All just absolutely moving in harmony. And he's standing on the moon. Try to visualize yourself there. And then he looks to his right, and he can see this blue quarter shining in the sky. And that's the Earth. That's what it looks like, about the size of a quarter from standing on the moon. Bright blue like our sky. And he said he had this awareness that everything that we've ever worried about or consumed ourselves with or been troubled by was on this quarter. This quarter. And beyond the quarter was more heavenly bodies just hurling all movement. And every problem, every difficulty, every war, whether or not our children are going to grow, whether our business is going to work, whether it didn't work, that back, you know, Genghis Khan, I mean, it doesn't, cavemen, Neanderthal ages, Ice Age, all of it. It's on this quarter. And he's standing here. And he said he had this, like, satori, this instant awakening. And it was that this is an intelligent system that we are all a part of. And I said, Ed, you would think that someone with a PhD from the most prestigious university in the world in the study of science would know that before they got into the capsule. He said, no. He said, we studied how to be in charge of matter and how to be in charge of our world. We never studied the spiritual consequences of travel in space. And he said, he came back from the moon, from the Apollo 14 flight, and he left the space program. He left NASA. And since that time, for the last 21 or 22 years, he founded the Institute for Noetic Sciences, and he has been lecturing about the spiritual implications of space travel and what it did to him as a human being. His talks are wonderful. Now, if that is true, just accept that that is true, that this is an intelligent system that we are a part of, that there's an intelligence about it that flows through it all. And you also are a part of that intelligence that is your life here, from the time that you showed up until the time that you leave, in this parentheses in eternity, which is your life. It opens parentheses in that split second when one drop of human protoplasm collides with another, and everything you needed for this physical journey is handled for you. It's all handled. And that's the physical journey. But there's also another journey that you're on that is not physical, that divine, formless, unbounded intelligence that flows through you and watches this physical you go through all of its motions. And you sort of stand back and you become like an observer to your own life. And you're watching it do all of the things that it does. Strange and wonderful things are happening to your form all the time. I know strange and wonderful things have been happening to my form since I showed up here. And I watch it all, and I'm intrigued by it, but I never identify with it. I'm detached from it. I'm observing it. I'm watching it.